Today is taken from 2 Thessalonians 2, and this is from the Message version. Friends, read these next words carefully. There's no need to go jumping to conclusions regarding the day when Jesus Christ will come back. Don't let anyone shake you up over some breathless report or rumoured letter from me that the day of the Master's arrival has come and gone. Don't fall for any line like that. Before that day comes, a couple of things have to happen. First, a whole-scale rebellion against God. And second, the debut of one completely opposed to Jesus Christ. This opposer will embody evil and take over every so-called God or altar, setting himself up as God Almighty. This is the same detail I gave when I was with you. You'll also remember that I told you the opposer is being held back until just the right time. That doesn't mean that evil isn't already at work. There is no shortage of evil right now, for sure, but it will let loose and run riot. Yet we should not worry. Jesus will be right there and will blow him away. He can do that in just a breath. Evil brings power, signs, and miracles that are all fake. Many will be deceived. Those who reject the good news will have their choices confirmed, being swallowed up in all this stuff. Meanwhile, we can continually thank God for you, our good friends, because you are loved by God. You were among the first to be included in God's saving plans, to have the Spirit at work in you as you came to believe in Jesus. So friends, stand firm. Keep a tight grip on what you were taught, whether in personal conversation or by our letter. May Jesus himself and God our Father, who reached out to you in love and surprised you with gifts of unending help and confidence, put a fresh heart in you, invigorate your work, and enliven your speech.
If we can go to the Eliade slide, please, Ollie. Well, last week it became public that digital cinema media had declined the Church of England Just Pray advert that we saw a few moments ago, which of course features the Lord's Prayer. Now note that this was not a ban, as many have suggested in the media and on social media, but the outworking of the long-held policy by the media company to not screen any ads of a political or religious nature. Their policy is held because of the risk, as they see it, of offence, which was the reason that their spokesperson gave regarding this ad, which then led to many asking, how could this possibly offend? It's been interesting to see the public reaction of different figures, types of people, through this week. Richard Dawkins, the militant atheist and secularist, originally said that the ads wouldn't offend and should be screened, though he later retracted that tweet once he realised that this was not an issue of free speech, but a commercial policy choice by the media company. The Muslim Council of Britain were flabbergasted, saying that there is no offence at all in showing the Lord's Prayer. Some claimed that it limits free speech, having such a policy. And although it was a commercial policy, that policy could itself be open to legal challenge for the reason that you cannot deny doing business on religious grounds. Some then noted that mounting a legal challenge would be simply doing the same as the world does, following the ways of the world, and so advised against that course of action. Some wise Christians noted that the Lord's Prayer, by its very nature, is offensive. It asserts that God is God, that God's kingdom should rule, that we are not random objects to consume and always want more. All these things fly in the face of our consumer culture and the things that that culture wants us to believe. Many Christians said, this is ridiculous. We are supposed to be a Christian country. And it's that claim where I think we must ask ourselves more carefully how the good news fits. The reality is that we are a country with a strong and rich Christian heritage. But whether we are a Christian country, I would suggest we need to debate. Since neither Jesus nor the New Testament do not really tell us what such a concept should actually mean. Instead, 1 Peter suggests that as Christians we live as foreigners in the land, and foreigners typically have fewer rights. The point is that the world must do its thing. It will take its decisions. It will form its policies, which may block an advert, one day may do worse. But the power of God to change lives will remain and be active. God's kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Let's continue in our worship as the musicians lead us. Please do take a seat and we'll try and understand that passage, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And when you read it and you read it in its entirety, we had an abridged version from the Message translation this morning. But when you try and work through it, it has no shortage of difficulties, real headaches. How to make sense of it. The commentary that I use for 1 and 2 Thessalonians says that this is one of the hardest passages in the New Testament to interpret. So good luck. Augustine, who lived at the end of the AD 300s, just into the AD 400s, founding father of Western theology, much of what we believe, of what we teach in church today, is rooted in what this guy Augustine wrote in the late 300s and early 400s. And in one of his books, one of his most famous books, The City of Gods, which he wrote in AD 410, he wrote, "I frankly confess," this is talking about this passage, "I frankly confess, I do not know what it means." And that's the rock of Western theology, saying, "I haven't got a clue, move on." Well, it echoes what we've heard in previous weeks about Jesus' return. And maybe the situation for the Thessalonian Christians after that first letter was getting worse. So when Paul wrote the sequel, remember these letters are probably a to-and-fro correspondence, when he wrote back, he was trying to rescue a deteriorating situation. There was misunderstanding. There were people claiming that Paul had said things or had written things or someone had come with a prophecy or something, and it was shaking people up. People were saying, "Well, maybe Jesus has already returned and we've kind of missed it." And Paul is saying, "No, don't be deceived by any of that stuff. Don't go with these false reports. People will try and claim, oh, because of this sign, because of that sign, and there will be this date, it will all pan out like this. Don't be deceived by that kind of thing. Let's get back to the basics." And so he tries to correct them in some way. The problem is that in correcting them, he refers back to stuff that he had already verbally told the Thessalonians when he was with them in his travel around Turkey, what's now Turkey and Greece and so on. He had given them verbal instructions. And do you know what? Nobody had written them down. Oh, so we don't have them today. There's a hole in material that we have. If only someone had been making notes or tapped it into their iPad or uploaded it to the web or something, then it would be easier to understand this passage. But we don't have that material. And so there is a gap in how we can understand it. But that's okay, because there's enough to be going on with. And the Christian faith is a relationship, and relationship requires work and effort and progress. There's stuff that we have to wrestle with. For those who want the Christian faith to just be a download from a textbook or from the web or from someone's instruction, they're missing the point. A relationship requires work, and it will require us to wrestle with some stuff that is hard to understand as we get to know Jesus. Remember our motto verse throughout this year, when I was doing the news sheet with Wendy, she's saying, well, what's that down there? And I said, well, we use that verse throughout the whole year. And this year it's Ephesians 1:17, to get to know Christ better. That will require us wrestling with stuff and wrestling with Jesus. Help me understand this. But one thing is clear from this passage. Until Jesus returns, evil, bad stuff will loom large. In fact, it may even increase. And Paul talks of this great opposer in many translations. It talks about a man of lawlessness who this power will lead many people in the opposite direction to Jesus Christ, away from the good news, setting himself or itself up as God, and yet curiously held back in some way. Curiously not allowed to do its worst. We don't know what it is holding it back. Maybe it's the powers of law and order that God, through governments and leaders, institutes in society. I go back to Augustine. Don't know. But maybe it's those powers of law and order. And that would make some sense. Because look what happens when law and order is removed or disintegrates. And we see that in places in our world today. In the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, where law and order has disintegrated or simply evaporated, you get chaos and you get people or groups asserting themselves as supreme, requiring absolute allegiance. And we see that played out around our world in different places today. And we have to try and make sense of it all. We have to try and make sense of global terrorism, Paris, our own streets, even cinema ads, which won't be shown. But don't jump to a conclusion and say, oh, well, that means it must be. Because the reality is that these kinds of things have been happening all through history. In AD 40, just a few years after Jesus' death, Emperor Gaius tried to desecrate the Jewish temple. And in AD 70, another Roman Empire came and did trash the Jewish temple and took over the city in a fresh way. In a sense, there is nothing new under the sun. These kind of atrocities and terrible, terrible things and total breakdown happen and recur again around the world. So in that kind of turmoil and uncertainty, how are we to react? Is it to be in worry, in fear? Or should we as Christians somehow be stomping our feet and saying it shouldn't be like this and fix it now? Or should we simply fix our eyes and look to Christ? Go to the next slide. And as Rachel illustrated with the children, stand firm. Don't be consumed by the details. Don't be all tangled up in the whys and wherefores. But look to Jesus. Our calling, our task in the face of whatever evil, whatever bad stuff happens, whatever disappointments, whatever sadnesses there are, to stand firm as it says in verse 15. Actually, a minister in one of our sister connection churches gave me a wonderful illustration for this a few weeks ago. The guy down in Chesham, it's called Rosedale Community Church. It's one of the other connection churches. And this guy's American, and as a late teenager, he played American football, you know, with all the gear and the padding and the stuff that they have and the helmet. And the instructions that they gave these lads playing American football was quite simple. The ultimate goal is to get the ball to the end zone, down the other end of the field. So if you happen to get the ball, simply fix your eyes on the end zone and try and move forward as much as you can. And if you can't move forward because a load of other guys fall on top of you, simply try and stand your ground, because every yard forward is a yard gained. So don't even, if a big bloke is coming at you, don't even try and dodge them, because it will go horribly wrong. Just simply go straight forward. And that's what he learned to do. That's how American football is played. You look to the end and you try and get there, even if the whole other team is piling into you. And he said, that is our task as Christians, to fix our eyes on the goal, on Jesus. And whatever happens, whatever big stuff comes hurling at us, to just keep our eyes fixed and try and go forward, or at least stand. And if we move forward another yard, it's another yard gained. But at least we stand. And that is what this passage is saying to us. So stand firm, fix our eyes, and if we can, we'll gain another yard. Because eventually, it leads to the glory that is in Jesus Christ, as it says in verse 14, that we might share. I'm going to hand over to Rachel.
It's quite a challenge, isn't it? As Carl just said, actually, to keep your eyes fixed on something that you would then aim for and hope for that happy ending. And as we were talking and planning this morning, it made me think about those films that come with happy endings, the good old black and white ones which finished with this. And I wonder if I was to ask you, actually, which are your favourite films that have a happy ending? I wonder what springs to mind. Well, we were one of the few who put up our Christmas decorations yesterday, before December. And Christmas time, when you get your Radio Times and get your highlighter out, as you used to in the good old days, and we probably still will, but it reminds me of one film with a happy ending that my parents used to watch every Christmas, called It's a Wonderful Life. Do you know it? James Stewart. That has one happy ending, the simple life of a guy who's totally ill at ease with his life and is taken out of it to view it from the outside by an angel. And he comes to the conclusion, a happy ending, that actually his life is great all along, and he's happy to go back to it. It might be that your happy ending film is a romantic comedy like Notting Hill. Hugh Grant, the simple bookshop owner who falls in love with a glamorous film star, who does turn his eye, if that's the right phrase, or does notice him in the end, and there's a happy ending. Or maybe you're subjected to all the Disney films, the Beauty and the Beast, the whatever it may be on Disney or Pixar. Or maybe it's Westerns, whatever it may be. Actually, all of these films, particularly at Christmas time, come on our radar, don't they? But clearly, films like that are not what we're talking about today. Are they happy endings? Are lovely, they're simple, they're sweet, they make you kind of feel all gushy inside. But actually, this morning, in the light of talking about, yes, the evil that is around us that we've heard about, yes, the determination that might rise up in us to stand firm, what strikes me is that this isn't a gushy, happy ending story. Is it like some of the romantic comedies? Actually, what we can stand firm in is the fact that we believe in God, who overturned the world, who not only overcame it, but who died, who came back to life. And if you flick on the next slide there, Ollie, it tells us actually this isn't some soppy story that makes us feel all warm. This doesn't make you kind of go, ah, inside. This makes me go, boom. This is the God who actually did overturn history, where everything changed. And the next slide shows us some of these verses, which might be familiar to us, But I'm going to recap on these today. Because in the light of where I feel, we're in a culture and a context where everything is raging around us, isn't it? Both sometimes for us personally and certainly in the world around us. For me, this draws me back to this point of saying, actually, this brings us to today, to believe in a Jesus who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. You've probably heard it many times, but let's read it together this morning and believe it. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. He says, I am the light of the world. We remember Advent, starting today, talks about light, doesn't it? Jesus says, I am the light of the world. We believe in God who forgives the mess that that we've made, all of us, and will clear that up. And like the psalm says, actually will take the wrong things that we've done and take them as far away from us as the east is from the west, as that psalm says. We believe in God who gives joy, who brings peace, who loves, who saves, who listens, who prepares a place for us in heaven. And ultimately then, I'm going to wrap all that up and say that this is God who has overcome the world. That to me is a boom moment. These are the stand firm principles that the Bible lays out for us. Yes, we may know them. Yes, we might have heard them from our youth, or we might have heard them more recently than that. But actually, in the light of turmoil, surely some of these things are what we come back to. So when we say Jesus has overcome the world, I wonder what that really means. It might make us question, well, what does that look like? How can we know that? It made me think of an experience I had about 2 years ago. We were in our old house before we moved. And I remember one day being at home, I think Jacob was small, and having two Jehovah's Witnesses come to the door and one young teenage girl in tow, and opening the door and having a little bit of time and so getting into a bit of conversation with them. And the one thing that I remember is that they were determined in talking to me about the fact that Jesus was coming back, which we agreed on quite easily. But the point that they wanted to make, and I realised they really wanted to stress this, was that when Jesus came back, that they believed there was going to be a new heaven and a new earth. Well, there was lots of points to agree on, that I agreed that Jesus was coming back, and in my simple mind, if Jesus was coming back, then that meant that we were going to be with God, and that that was going to be a good thing. And as we spoke a little bit, they pursued and pursued with me the fact that there was going to be a new heaven and a new earth. And were asking me, well, what does that look like? Does that mean that, in your understanding, is heaven going to be here on earth? Or what does the new earth look like? Or what does the new heaven look like? And being a bit bamboozled by all their questions, I must admit, the only thing that I could think to say was, to me, it doesn't matter. If actually what it means is that Jesus is coming back, and whatever that looks like, and maybe it's my small brain, but I don't think any of us can really comprehend that, can we? But actually, does the detail matter? To my mind, it doesn't. And all that I could say to them is that surely if we're going to be with God, whether that's here, there, up in heaven, new earth, whatever, frankly, that doesn't matter. Because actually what's ultimately important is my childlike belief that actually to be with God will be in a good place. When we look at the world around us and we look at the questions that arise, when we look at the atrocities that we've seen recently all over the world, sometimes it does lead us to question, why do these things happen? What is God doing about it? Why hasn't he intervened? But actually, we're called, as Carl said, to stand firm. And my question to myself is actually, in the midst of that, does the detail matter? At the end of the summer, a friend of mine who reads very widely on blogs and so on across the world was looking really into the end times. And actually, I was quite surprised at some of the stuff that he was looking at, which was predicting, from all that he'd read, that that Jesus was going to be coming back at the end of September. And predicted the exact date. And all that that did for me, I must admit, and in a few conversations around that time I had with people, was provide a real sense of unrest and of fear in people, not just one of questions. For me, the detail doesn't matter. Surely if we know God and we trust God, if we know that God is a God of impeccable timing that is planned in his economy and is perfect, then surely it's better for all of us to return to that simple childlike faith and just simply put our trust in the big picture of who God is and leave the detail to him. As Carl mentioned earlier, there's nothing new under the sun, is there? All of these things have been seen, been done before. There have been evil people in our times. There are today and there will be into the future. But there is increased threat within that. But within that, I really believe that we have a choice as to how to respond. This was made really obvious to me earlier in the week. It was on Tuesday, late afternoon, and I'd finished work and I'd picked up Jacob and Isaac and was heading home, or just got home. I rang Darren, who I knew was on the way down to yet another Arsenal match. But I rang Darren because I knew we often speak before he heads down the train. He was with a friend. And I said, "Oh, you've left work. How are you getting on?" And Darren said, "I'm going down to the Arsenal ground. We had to leave a bit early today because they're doing extra security checks after what happened last week. So we'll go through the security and then go into the match." And in that moment, I thought, oh my goodness, I hadn't even thought that actually what had been happening in Paris and so many other places in the world would directly impact Darren going to an Arsenal match. But of course, that is an obvious possibility, that something could happen in a stadium filled with 60,000 people. And in that moment, just as I'd got in the house and dropped everything, I just thought, whoa, I could actually spend the next 3 hours or 4 hours being really anxious about this and actually thinking, what if, what might happen, what can I do? Nothing. And I just prayed in that moment. And it really struck me, and again, in light of speaking to you this morning about this, it really struck me in that moment I had a choice. I had a choice to go with what is human worry, but I had a choice to really indulge that and to allow myself to be fearful, to worry, to ask Darren to text me every half hour and let me know that he was okay. Or I had a choice to ground myself in the knowledge that God was with Darren, that God had it in hand, that I could do nothing at all, and that I would pray that all would be well. It struck me just in reflecting on that simple little moment in my week that actually we have a real choice within this, don't we? Within all of our situations, whether they're good or bad, whether life is rosy at the moment, or whether it's full of conflict or anxiety leading up to Christmas or whatever it might be, looking at the world picture. But we can either choose to worry and concentrate on the detail, seek out what's going to happen, when our time might be up, whether we'll lose our job, whether we'll keep it, whether our children will grow up okay or whether they won't. Or the alternative is to decide clearly and firmly to give those fears to God, to pray hard, to stand firm in the truth, and to entrust all of these things to God. There's a powerful verse on the next slide, which you may know from 1 John 4, which just says this: perfect love casts out all fear. If you can go back, Ollie, thank you. Perfect love casts out all fear. Those verses that we mentioned earlier tell us that Jesus has overcome. This isn't a trifling little fact, is it? If we are Christians who believe that, this is a stand firm fact that Jesus has overcome. And therefore, in the midst of that, yes, we might worry. But certainly from my life so far, through whether it's been Darren moving job at the start of recession, whether it's mum having bowel cancer, whether it's the simple thing of the Arsenal game this week, Jesus has proved himself to me, to us, time and time and time and time again. So yes, we might worry, but let's choose together, grabbing hold of each other where needs be, to actually know that God's love casts out fear, and in him we can trust forevermore. We're going to watch a clip now, which is of a film which you may have seen, and probably maybe on our screens again at Christmas time. It's from The Chronicles of Narnia. And you might know the clip, but it's a clip that I've remembered for probably at least about 15 years. And, well, hopefully you'll see. But this is a picture of the White Witch who encounters Aslan. And in this moment, you see her response to Aslan, believing that she's won. Let's watch this clip.
You have a traitor in your midst, Aslan.
His offense was not against you.
Have you forgotten the laws upon which Narnia was built?
Do not cite the deep magic to me, witch. I was there when it was written.
Then you'll remember well that every traitor belongs to me. His blood is my property.
Try and take him then.
Do you really think that mere force will deny me my right? Little king. Aslan knows that unless I have blood, as the law demands, all of Narnia will be overturned and perish in fire and water. That boy will die on the stone table. As is tradition. You dare not refuse me.
Enough. I'll talk with you alone. She has renounced her claim on the son of Adam's blood.
How do I know your promise will be kept?
In that clip, you see the picture of the White Witch, who just as the enemy in that picture comes in with that slightly smug approach, doesn't she, of waltzing up, thinking that she's captured the boy who's given into temptation and has betrayed Aslan. And in that picture, the reason that I love it is because whilst the White Witch thinks she's won and she approaches Aslan, what you see right at the end of that clip is that as she pushes and she pushes and she pushes and she tries to get what she thinks she's owed, what you see at the end there, as Aslan comes out of the tent and he's obviously sacrificed himself, as the story goes on, for the boy, is what I love is that just one moment where she pushes him that bit too far and you get that almighty roar, don't you? Did you hear that bit? And that almighty roar speaks so powerfully to me, which is why I've remembered it over all these years. Because to me, that says, whatever is going on, whatever power she thought she had, and with Aslan representing God for us in this story, her power was so absolutely minute, tiny and minuscule that in the light of Aslan and that roar, it snuffed her out in a second. And so today when we talk about looking at the evil in the world around us, the difficult stuff that happens, looking at standing firm, convincing ourselves if we need to, that we can stand firm because we know who God is. Actually, let's remember, like that picture shows us, that Jesus has already overcome. That we might not see it every little day, but ours is the challenge to stand firm within that. I'm just going to finish by reading some words from Psalm 93, which I think speak about this faith and trust that we can have in exactly that, that Jesus has overcome. And I'd encourage you, just as we read this, that if you're feeling fearful today of actually wanting to know God's peace, but maybe not feeling it, whether that's because of family, the world around you, anything that's being thrown at you at the moment, then maybe think about asking somebody to pray with you, which we'd love to later on. But these words in Psalm 93 say this: the Lord is King, he is robed in majesty. Indeed, the Lord is robed in majesty and armed with strength. The world stands firm and cannot be shaken. Your throne, O Lord, has stood from time immemorial. You yourself are from everlasting past. The floods have risen up, O Lord. The floods have roared like thunder. The floods have lifted their pounding waves. But mightier than the violent raging of the seas, mightier than the breakers on the shore, the Lord above is mightier than these. Your royal laws cannot be changed. Your reign, O Lord, is holy forever and ever. So as we close this morning, in just a moment's time, my encouragement to myself and to you is to let not our hearts be troubled. that we know that that perfect love that we can grasp just a tiny bit of does cast out fear, and that Jesus has overcome, and that whatever we're facing today, this week, in the months or years to come, that God will provide a way for us in these difficult times, because he is ultimately King of the world.